Continuing side two, May 31, 1978, with Mr. Horsfield. Sorry about the tape here.
Well, they got better as they went along.
No. Was there a clean sweep of these particular fellows,
yes,
or what?
Give you an example. One of them was kicked upstairs from being chief of air staff. He was made inspecting director of the Air Force, and his job was to go around and inspect every unit and everything else, you see. And strangely enough, he was a wonderful fellow, very popular and very nice, but he just didn't have it upstairs, you know. He was popular and we all liked him, but he just hadn't got it. For instance, he walked into the
recruit. What was his name?
You know, I've seen so many come and go, I can't remember his
name.
But there's so many of them. They just came and went after months, you know. It was I'm not sure. I wouldn't say, because I'm not certain.
Okay.
I could make a guess, but I wouldn't be absolutely sure. But we had had the whole sixth floor of the Royal Bank building in Vancouver turned into a reception center for recruiting. A very large staff and 32 doctors there and one thing and another. And he came around to inspect it when it had been built. And he came in and he said, well, Horsfield, and he looked around, he said, there's only thing one wrong with this building. He said, in the bullpen here, that's where was a space railed off where all the people waiting to join the Air Force sat with books and stuff to read to them. He said, I think that there should be a separate gate over here to allow the women who want to join them to come in that gate and sit on this side. And I said, yes, sir. And he pushed off, you see. And I got nuts. You see, I mean, so I didn't do a bloody thing, you see. So he made an unexpected descent on me about a couple of months later and rushed into my office and said, there, Horsfield, don't you think it's a lot better in that bullpen now that you've got the gate over there? And I said, yes, sir, of course, I never put a gate in. So. But it was just, you see, they don't know what to do. They've had a good position, and now they're faking around and just inventing things, you know.
So more like promotion sideways, too.
Yeah. I tell you a very a thing that'll amuse you, but I had 32 doctors there, and doctors in L services are very awkward way to get on with. Always have been, always will be. They have no idea of military discipline at all, or anything to do with anything of that nature. They're people unto themselves, little gods unto themselves, you see. And as I said, I had five units, and they were all interdependent, and you had to talk to these people on the phone. And I thought it would be a good idea if I got all the officers from all the different units together once a month. So I issued orders that the last Friday night in every month would be a mess night, which would be held at the Georgia Hotel. Because, you see, everybody are living out in billets and everything else, and they don't get together. So I said it will be a mess night, and there'll be a slight charge for food and that sort of thing, but everybody will be able to talk to his opposite number and get acquainted and perhaps work out things that'll save a lot of correspondence. I issue this out as an order. Well, the next morning I receive a deputation of four doctors who say they're not going to this. They have no intention of going. So I looked at them and pulled out a volume of Air Force law and King's regulations, read them what I could do to them as a commanding officer, and that I could court-martial them for refusing to obey an order. But I said, instead of that, I won't do that because you're ignorant, you don't know what you're doing. So instead of that, I'll have you fallen in under the sergeant major in the morning at 7 o'clock and you would march to the foot of Drowse Mountain back again every morning for a month. Well, you never saw such a bunch of bewailing medical officers in your life. This went on for a few days, and they came in and said, apologized and said that they understood now what it was all about. And I said, all right, we'll stop the parade. We'll stop the parade.
So they didn't parade in front of the sergeant major?
Yeah. You know, they hadn't a clue, you see. Bloody clue. And, of course, you see, you're always very annoyed about doctors because they can enter a service, you know, three rungs up the ladder before anybody else has got started, you know.
Got started, yeah.
Yeah, so they're not very... Was there anything else?
Yeah, well, while you're in Ottawa, what about the Canadianization policy of the RCAF? Now, did you have any contact with that? I know there's a lot written now about this government desire to have the Canadian Air, you know, overseas forces, like Number 6 Bomber Group, for example, became RCAF. And they wanted the Canadians fighting with Canadians and Canadian units to get away from the RAF. I wonder if you had any contact with that and any thoughts.
Well, I know from the war. You see, this is from inside history that will interest you. But when the whole operation of aircrew and everything was designed, it was designed so that out of every 100 pilots, observers, or so-and-so, 40% would be commissioned in Canada. And that would be the end of it. Do you follow?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the war had been going for a while, and the Southern Press started a campaign. And the funny part about it was, the Southern head of the Southern Press, Southern himself, had a son in the Air Force. And when he graduated, he became a sergeant pilot.
Sergeant pilot, yes.
Yeah. And that must have upset the old man.
They all became sergeant pilots, though.
No, they didn't. 40% were commissioned.
Well, but they were sergeant pilots and then commissioned after they'd left training.
No, as soon as they qualified in training, 40% were commissioned.
So they were commissioned at training. Some were commissioned at training school itself. I wasn't aware of that.
Well, it doesn't. Not quite that. I think now, if I remember correctly, 20%, and then 20% as soon as they'd qualified again overseas, making 40%.
Okay.
I think that's probably the right. It was 40%, but I think it was split. Well, the Southern Press all across Canada started a campaign saying that everybody who qualified in aircrew at all should receive a commission, irrespective of anything else.
Simply because they were aircrew.
Yeah. Well, this was unthought of, and the Royal Air Force were furious with rage about this, because, you see, they depend largely on sergeant and non-commissioned officer pilots.
Well, there's more RCAF in the RAF than the RCAF overseas.
Yeah, but there were people who had joined the RAF.
No, there was Canadians who joined the RCAF in the RAF, flew with RAF squadrons, and were under RAF command.
Are you sure?
Yes, quite sure, sir. General Lane, for example, through a 35 squadron RAF, and there's only two Canadians.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's what part of the argument was about, because you had...
all in the RAF.
Yeah, you see, you had the RAF with lots of experience under a commission officer who didn't know as much about the job as they did as sergeants, you see, and so that would be probably the reason for the argument. But they argued like hell. But instead of doing what the RAF did, they worsened it up altogether. They raised this 40% to about 80% in two leaps, with the result that there was hardly any non-commissioned flying crew at all, you see, and which was a very expensive thing to do. But it was all on account of this bloody campaign, and the government didn't want to...
The government went along with this newspaper.
Yeah, sure.
Well, did you? I guess what I'm trying to get at is, do you recall anything at the time that struck you odd about the Canadianization policy? Did you think it was hokey? Did you think it was a good thing?
I wouldn't say about it, because I don't know enough about it. I would only see the paperwork at our end. I wouldn't know the commissioning was under directorate of personnel and manning.
Well, it's not just commissioning. And this leads me into my second question of a lot of Canadian pilots. I'm talking about overseas pilots.
Yes, yeah.
A lot of them were under RAF control. I mean, like Bomber, yeah. Even Number 6 Bomber Group came under Bomber, Bomber
yeah, oh
Command,
yes,
which
they
was
would
RAF.
Come under, oh, yes, sure, they'd come under the top command, yeah.
And I guess what I'm trying to get at now is what liaison and what kind of decision-making was coming from Air Force headquarters with the RAF from the United Kingdom. Was it an ally coordinated, or was Air Force headquarters in Ottawa making Canadian policy that weren't...
No, they weren't. Well, when I say they weren't, they used to send someone over at regular intervals to CONFAM in London with these birds, and I remember them going over, but what the whole thing they did, I don't know. I don't know anything about it. But I know they sent people over, and they sent Air Marshal Sully over on one occasion. They sent different air marshals over, I know, to settle disputes with one thing or another, or argument that happened between the RAF and RCEF. But I wouldn't know what they were, unfortunately.
And I think what just leaves us with Quebec, but you don't want to talk about Quebec.
No, I don't like Quebec. Yeah. I mean, they just say that as far as I'm concerned, they didn't pull their weight, and not only that, but they tried to splutch the whole thing up as well. They got no use for them at all.
Were there many French-Canadian officers in the Air Force in Ottawa itself?
No, one that I knew of, a chap called de Niverville, who was a nice chap. And he was in before the war, you see, and stayed on. But I don't remember any others at all. They're practically non-existent.
I guess the last thing that I want to talk to you today about is just personalities. I think any anecdotes about Billy Bishop or a few of these people, do you call offhand?
Well, I met Billy Bishop. Well, I knew him very well, and liked him immensely. They made him director of recruiting, and they brought in another famous man like him, who, you see, it's hard. I don't like putting things down about people that's not good, but this man was highly decorated. He was no bloody good at all. He was drunk morning, noon, and night.
Who is this fellow?
Oh, I wouldn't say his name.
You won't say his name? Well, that doesn't do it.
No, I mean, it's true. I mean, he'd done a wonderful job in the First War, but that was the trouble. They would dig up these people, and not realizing that people change, and give them high rank, and then God help you. But he kept out of everybody's way because he was never sober enough to interfere.
Was drinking a big thing?
It always is in Air Forces,
Pressure, you think?
Oh, and a rather funny thing about that too. We made an inquiry once as to why there were so many training accidents on Sunday morning. We found out that it was these budding young pilots who flying over to show their girlfriends that they'd met how well they could fly, see? They'd run into the ground.
No.
So that had to be stopped. But I tell you another extraordinary thing came out in statistics. The best navigators came from base BC. The best pilots came from the Prairie Provinces. And I think it was the best air gunners came from Ontario. I had it all down, but I rather slipped now. But the best pilots were always prairies.
They're always from the prairie.
Yeah. Yeah. We used to keep a lot of statistics and them, whether they were worthwhile or not, but at first, when the first thing started, you know, they had all this air crew, and they found that there was enormous wastage. They picked people, and the end of the training period, they'd be done. And they worked out that a pilot cost $25,000 to train, a navigator $30,000 to train, and an air gunner about $18,000 to train, each person. And when the thing was over, we found we weren't getting
money
for it. So they decided that they would bring in aptitude tests, intelligence tests and aptitude tests. And they had a firm in Chicago and a firm in New York who produced these series of tests. And we put them into operation. And they were good in some respects, and they certainly cut down the wastage. Not as much as expected, but it did cut down some of the wastage. But they never found out a method of cutting down the man who really didn't want to fly at the end of all this.
Well, the reluctant pilot?
Yeah. We used to try all sorts of stunts and gadgets to try and cut it out, but you could never entirely cut it out. You know what they called it, did you? Lack of LMF? Lack of
moral fiber.
Yeah. And there was quite a bit of that. But there always will be. I mean, you can't...
It wasn't LMF more... isn't that different from the reluctant pilot, the one who really didn't like to fly?
No, yes, it is, but... I don't know why the difference would come in there, but I suppose it must be different. I can't imagine anybody not wanting to fly.
Well, you're a pilot, that's not fair. Did you get to do any flying? During the second war?
With the Harvard trainer. I flew quite a bit with the Harvard trainer.
What did they go?
Oh, they're wonderful. But a very amusing experience I had there. I had my own pilot I could ring up, you know, and take me. He took me down to Toronto to attend a meeting, and we get back into the cockpit. He said, all right, you take her over and take her back to Rockcliffe at Arnold. So I take over, and I said, what's the compass bearing? He said, oh, you don't need one. Just follow those power lines down there. I look over in these power lines, you know. I said, okay. He said, I'm going to have a sleep. So he slept to sleep. And this was a gag because he's 20 miles out of Toronto. They go underground, you see. And of course, you're not noticing. You don't have a lot of bloody power lines, you see. I bounce around, you know, looking for these. I thought I'd wake up Helen gone off course. I'm going to where I want, you know. So I couldn't get my bearings at all. So I dived him down and shook him up a bit, and he still pretended to be asleep, you know. He was a dirty dog.
Yes, it still goes on today. There's always something.
Yes, there's always a bit of fun. Yeah, and I came out in 43 to see. I had to visit all the air stations in the Air Command, the Western Air Command.
Mm-hmm.
And I tied in with Joan, and she was living in Victoria, and I took off. Well, terrible. It was December, wasn't it?
Yeah.
December. The worst December we've ever had here. God almighty. It took me months to get around B.C. We get fogged in at Billikula, and we were, couldn't get out for ice, and oh God, we had a hell of a time. And we had a big cancer amphibian, and we landed at the Halliford Bay in the Charlottes, and the whole runway was covered in ice, and we put the pilot, now he's sitting co-pilot next to him, putting brakes on. It was just like a sled. We went right off the end of the runway, through a lot of trees and down into the sea.
Yeah. Very
funny.
The trigger to you, my old says, everybody is out to get the can. Tell you a funny story about overseas. This was in the Moose Squadron. I've forgotten the number of the Moose Squadron. The Moose Squadron. What was called the Moose Squadron?
I'd have to look that up. I don't know which one's the Moose.
But anyway, they were stationed somewhere in Lincolnshire. They were all having a good time, and all bombers, of course. And they had a fellow in the mess there, and he never bought anybody a drink, you know? And they'd always buy him drinks, but he'd never buy anybody else one. So he'd come into the mess, and he'd drunk with everybody, and he'd got tight, and he'd loosened his battle jacket, and he'd gone back in a chair and gone to sleep. And they were talking about him, and said, one of them said, well, let's teach him a lesson. So the chap said, all right. And these two pilots went out and went into the farm next to the aerodrome, and they stole a goose. And they cut this goose's head off, took out all its entrails, and put all the entrails in this goose. In his loose jacket here, you see. And here is all these entrails. And then they took the bloody knife that killed the goose with, you see, and put it in his hand, and put his hand on the thing. And then they all start to drink, waiting for him to wake up, you see. Well, he woke up, you see, and he looks around, he looks down, and he grabbed his thing. I said, lightly, brandy, double brandy. He looked at the knife in his hand, he looked at all these guts, he really thought he'd, yeah. Well, they can be really, really cruel.
Well, I guess it's, horseplay, tomfoolery, whatever, was there accidents on this? I imagine a lot of people must have been seriously hurt when they were fooling around.
Oh, yeah, I've seen lots of people hurt. They had all sorts of, I nearly got damn well hurt once, foolishly. I was reading a book in my pajamas in my bedroom, you know, in a hut. And a fellow dashed into me and he said, come on, Dick, they're doing all sorts of tricks in the mess. He said, you don't want to miss it. Well, I said, I'm in my pajamas. He said, well, put your British warm on and come on in anyway. He said, nobody cares. So I put my British warm on, you see, and go in to the mess, and here they are, all doing stupid things like balancing on backs and seats of chairs, and some of them were lifting rifles by, all sorts of crackpot things, you see, and in one corner there's some fellows fooling around with a long bench, and he takes me over to this bench, and he said, watch this is funny, and they had this fellow on the bench like this, you see, laid flat, gripping the end of the bench. Then two of them would lift it up this end slowly and see how long he could bear his weight on his fingers, on his hands.
Clenching his fist?
Yeah, clutching the hand. He got to a certain height, he'd just let go and slide off, you see, and he just turned to me. He said, Dick, you can do better than that, you see. And there's a concrete floor there, and here's this long bench. So I get on the long bench, being an absolute fool, get my hands on here. And they start lifting. I thought, my God, they're going slow and heavy, dripping like Zoom Death. And they'd unrolled the fire hose and had the nozzle down.
travels a leg, you know, my legs. And they get it up to this height, so it's just nice, and they turn it on. And I went off that like a rocket. I just flew into the wall at the other end. And I grabbed a chair. I came back with this chair, you know, and they couldn't run for laughing. I managed to get a couple of cracks in.
I was mad, really mad.
So just to break the monotony, break the board?
Oh, yes, that's break it, yeah. Mm-hmm. I told you about them putting a lot of very cartridges in my tent. Well, you see, the next night what I did was nip into the farmer's field next door, get some turnips, and ran these turnips under their tin chimneys all the way around.
Smoke them all.
Sure. Oh, it was all that. I mean, just one damn thing after another. And then Beeksburn one night, just getting dusk, and they said there were planes coming over, and we go out, and here's a Beeksburn squadron of fighters coming over. And they'd just been issued with canisters, which fitted underneath your plane. And you pulled a toggle, and that thing fell down, the lid came off, and it shot about 500 or 600 incendiary bullets. Well, not bullets, but incendiary shells set things on fire, you know, and they'd slide out of the chute. Well, Beeksburn had filled all these things with small paper bags of soot and small paper bags of flour, thousands of them, you see. And of course, when they flew over, we all ran out, you see, to watch them. You never saw such a mess in your life. They just let go. And there were 15 planes, you know, and there'd be 500 or 600 of these things in each one, and they just pulled the toggle and it just rained these paper bags of soot and flour. Absolutely crackers. But that was it.
Well, I think we're just about done. Thank you very much.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Again, you know, and... Yeah.